101, a version 1 podcast.
We're all extremely welcome this morning. So we have hopefully an interesting discussion today. Pick up from where we started there, that discussion around, look, this is algorithms, it is data science, it's how we use data, it's how we drive our businesses. But the ethical questions associated with that, we're going to try and touch on many topics within that. I know that in the room, we've got people from many different industry sectors, from finance to healthcare to education to many, many different sectors. There's no one single answer here. But hopefully we'll touch from high-level concepts of ethics through to regulation, through to privacy, but hopefully well beyond that, and the implications of algorithms and so forth. So you're very, very welcome today. So on our panel, first of all, we have Joan Cahill from the Centre for Innovative Human Systems at Trinity College, Niall O'Neill, Chief Strategy Officer with OneView Healthcare, Dr. Catherine O'Keefe, Chief Ethicist with Castlebridge, and Garvin Callan, Financial Services Technical Transformation Advisor with 101. So I'm going to ask them to each, rather than me give you a big long CV of everybody, much better that I start and maybe Joan just introduce yourself, give us a little bit of your own background.
Okay, well firstly, thanks everyone to coming to a discussion around ethics because it's a topic that's very important and very close to my heart. So I'm a human factors researcher and PI in the School of Psychology in Trinity College. So my research spans people, processes and technologies and issues around ethics, legal aspects of technology and the social acceptability of technology are very much at the core of human factors. So some people might think about human factors as about the human-machine interaction and the design of human-machine interactions, but actually it is beyond the user interface. And we can talk a little bit more about that, what that means in a while.
Okay. And just, Joan, just to put us in context, just before we start, just as part of your introduction, perhaps.
Yes.
You're coming from philosophy and other aspects of that. What is ethics?
Okay, so my background is both philosophy and psychology, and the intersections between those. Ethics is all about the moral quality of our actions and behavior. And it's a field in philosophy, it's called moral philosophy, and it has a set of tools and concepts which we use to evaluate the moral quality of our actions and behavior. So some of you, I think most of you in the room will be familiar with concepts of what is a good life? What is benefit? And how do we deliver benefit to human beings? And how do we harm them? Aspects like justice and virtue and goodness. So it uses these concepts along with certain theories. And there's many different theories. So from more like utilitarianism, which looks at evaluating our behavior in terms of the consequences, delivering the best outcomes for the greatest number of people, or deontology, which looks at, you know, concepts of duty and a principle-based approach. And there's also paradigms in virtue-based ethics. So they're all of use to us. And I would say, as a starting point, ethics is very much our friend. But we need to think about it in a certain kind of relationship. So I mean a friend that provides a perspective, that gives us help and assistance. So in ethics, as we all know, we don't get clear yes or no answers. So I think most of us are familiar with debates around euthanasia or how to deal with third world debt and famine, or, you know, even from the recent abortion campaign. People use ethical theories and principles to come to a view and assessment as to the moral quality of an action or behavior, or whether it's technology or whatever it might be. And they can come up with different ways of reasoning and different answers. So we can use moral theory to come up with two different views. So myself and Niall here might discuss healthcare and the use of patient monitoring technology and use moral theory differently and have a different view. So it's not giving us clear answers, but it's giving us tools, and we need to use these tools carefully.
And when we talk about ethics and data,
So ethics in terms of data analytics and machine and artificial intelligence is a specific area. It's applied ethics. So it's ethics in the real world, looking at real world scenarios. And I suppose technology, when we introduce new technologies, we're doing on the basis of progress and improvement. And we want to improve the quality of people's lives and improve it in terms of I suppose, concepts of well-being and quality of life. In the literature, there's three areas that in data analytics that we look at. We look at it in terms of the ethical quality of what machine learning and machine intelligence is. And this is around the data, the models, the algorithms, and the kind of outcomes and predictions we get from this, these models and algorithms. Then the second area is looking at, well, what does it do and how does it do it? So, for example, if you have technology that improves efficiencies in healthcare, how does it do it? Does it do it by monitoring staff using maybe like video technology? What are the ethical implications there? How does it affect the meaning and value of work and people's identity and their ability to do their job and to interact with patients? So that's the second area. And then the third area is overlapping. And this is where the bulk of my research would be. And it's around the impact of what it's doing and how it does it. So, for instance, you know, the impact in terms of, you know, new technology removing people's jobs or changing care relationships or, you know, transforming what it means to be human and changing concepts of rights.
Noel, that's a lot of ethics.
A lot of ethics before just about 9 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly. Yeah. Tell us about OneView Healthcare. Yes. And tell us about what does a chief strategy officer care about ethics?
Well, just a little bit about my background. So I actually studied English literature in Dublin. So my background is not technology, it's humanities. And I think that's an important point, you know, in the discussion around ethics that I think we should probably explore, you know, as we get into some of the questions. But I ended up in technology. I did management consulting and then moved to work with OneView Healthcare in 2014. So I've been with them for a number of years. And OneView's vision is to power personalized exemplary care. And we work with healthcare systems and senior care organizations, not in Ireland, sadly, but in the US market, in Australia. We do a little bit of stuff in the Middle East and Asia. And really, it's about, for us, it's about focusing on care that's provided in hospitals, so in the hospital room or in a nursing home or an aged care facility. And it's about using technology to improve the experience of care. And that's not just for the person, the patient or the senior that is receiving care, but it's also about the people who are providing care as well, because our belief is that the experience of care for a patient or a senior is ultimately most impacted by the human side of the care that they receive. So there's a tension here in terms of technology and, you know, it almost kind of seems like an oxymoron to think about technology as helping provide personalized care. But, you know, when you look at if you go to any hospital ward pretty much around the world, you'll find very similar things in terms of the pressure that nurses are under, the amount of work that they have to do, the running around from patient to patient, and their ability to actually spend, you know, quality time, you know, really human time in care is limited by all of the other things that they have to do. So we're looking at how we can provide technology not to replace the nurse or to, you know, automate the nurse or to replace nursing with robots or automation, but to use automation as a way to free the time that nurses have, that carers in nursing homes have, in order to provide better care, more human care. So that's what we do at OneView.
And is ethics actually a topic that exists in your strategy?
It is. So we actually worked with Joan around human factors research to inform the product that we're launching at the moment for senior care organizations. And that's really looking at not just the technical possibilities, but also looking at, you know, the application of the technology. So we're actually looking at a particular technology use case at the moment, for example, around how we can monitor care that's provided in a hospital room or in a room in a residential care facility. So today, you know, there's a huge scandal at the moment in Australia. I mean, there's been a scandal recently in Ireland, you know, around nursery care. Because people don't see what's happening in these rooms. So unless you're actually in the room when care is being provided, you don't know what's happening. You only know what someone has either written down about the care that was provided, or if there's been an audit, you know, to come in and to see the care that's being provided. Otherwise, you don't know what's happening. So we're looking at the possibility of technology to try and codify more about the care that's being provided in a room. And there are technologies, you know, in terms of ambient sensors, in terms of vision sensors, for example, and vision analytics that could allow you to codify that. So the technology exists that can do this. But the question then that we need to look at is, you know, is this something that we should do? And the questions we have to ask is, well, how, you know, would you feel if you're in hospital or if you're in a care home, how would you feel about this technology being in the room with you? And is the is the benefit to you enough for you to make, you know, trade-offs, you know, essentially from a privacy perspective? Or what do you need to do from a privacy perspective to make sure that there's not someone, you know, looking at a video feed, for example, of you essentially in your bedroom? But we believe that there are benefits to doing that as well. So, you know, for us, that's a real question of, you know, not can the technology do it, but should the technology do it? And how should you deploy that technology and engage people in the deployment of that technology such that it's in their best interests?
Excellent. Okay. I think that's a very interesting use case. I'm sure we'll be back to. Catherine, there's lots of kids go to school and they want to be teachers or they want to be firemen or they want to be astronauts. I doubt I've ever heard any child say, I want to be an ethicist when I grow up.
No, I wanted to be a ballerina when I grew up. And I actually spent a lot of time in the ballet studio. So I came to data ethics and data in general in a very roundabout way. I also studied literature after I got enough knee injuries that I couldn't do the professional ballet career. So I ended up in Ireland studying Oscar Wilde in particular, did a PhD on Hegelian philosophy and Wilde's fairy tales. So not exactly what you really necessarily expect to see someone here talking about ethics and data analytics, but it's all data. It's all looking at patterns. It's all figuring out what questions you're asking and how to define things, how to ensure that you are able to create knowledge and better understanding using the data and the patterns that you're finding. So oddly enough, it actually seems to be a good fit. My full job title is actually ethicist and director of training and research in Castlebridge, which is a small boutique consultancy. We're basically strategic data advisory. We do a lot around information management, regulatory compliance with GDPR, data literacy. But anything having to do with data, we're interested in it. So we're pretty much interested in everything. A few years ago, my colleague Dara and I were listening to everybody going around going, we need data ethics, we need data ethics. And that was pretty much the level of conversation that we were mainly seeing, particularly in areas of big data analytics and other data management disciplines. And so we took the ethical knowledge that we had and the data management knowledge that we had and said, you know what, everyone's talking about it. Here's the problems level. How do we actually get people to understand how they implement it in their organizations? And so that's really one of the things that I'm particularly very interested in doing. So Dara and I wrote a book about it, published it last year. It's called Ethical Information Management, Concepts, Tools, and Methods. And largely what we're trying to do instead of being at the very, very, very heady academic level is help people in data management and data analytics not reinvent the wheel when it comes to ethics, but bring the disciplines and the knowledge that they have to the idea, give them an introduction into ethics, as Joan gave you a lovely capitalized version there, and help them merge that with the knowledge and skills and sets that they already have so that they can apply it in their organizations. For instance, when you're talking about the question of what is the good, which is the big ethical question, the way you might be more used to thinking about it is what is quality? So what are our quality characteristics for data? So you do have some sort of discipline on deciding what quality characteristics to look for, how to measure them. Can you take that to think about what are the impacts on humans? How do we decide what the outcomes of our data analytics are? Is this a quality characteristic that is, again, are we increasing justice or are we increasing injustice? Accuracy, are we thinking about, are we representing reality truthfully and accurately? Or are we missing things because we're gathering data in a way that is missing a very, very important representative aspect of the human experience? And so that, you know, I think, feeds into what Joan's talking about quite a bit there. But it's figuring out how you can bring the tools that you have to the questions that you need to be asking and how to decide what questions you need to ask in order to answer them and get the answers you need.
Excellent. And just to finish, give me an example of the kind of sectors your customers are in. What business problems?
We work with everyone from startups to government. Utilities, transport sector, charities. Personally, I ended up working with the charities more often. But you know, when it comes to figuring out those ethical questions, they're very much pertinent, particularly to startups right now, because there's a lot of opportunity for, responsible innovation. And there's a lot of customer demand for more trustworthy and more beneficial products and organizations using data.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Garvin.
Ronan.
Financial services. Transformation advisor.
Yeah.
With 101.
Yeah. So, a proclamation. I would like to be an ethicist when I grow up. but I think that's a journey we're all on. I've been on I was on an in-industry career journey up until last year. So I worked in customer businesses for 10 years up to executive level. But for 16 years, I've been in transformation in a number of large financial services industries, banking, wealth management, corporates, and so on. And I've been really interested in the journey, and I've centered that period around digital. So I've been in digital for about 15, 16 years, as I say. And data and analytics is at the heart of that. You know, so digital is the application of technologies to create value, and technologies are information technologies, ergo information and the harvesting of the data, therefore. And when I look back at what's happened in financial services, but I work outside of financial services as well. I work in telco, I work in education, I work in with some state organizations as well. And where digital started was very much at the customer. So we think about the rise of Google and Facebook. I mean, it was all about creating that value on marketing. So it was very much started in the marketing space. Then it moved into channels, and then it moved into self-service. With the explosion of mobile and Smack and so on. But it's really interesting to see how it's progressed really deep down into organizations now. And it went from, customer marketing into channels, into operations. And then data analytics really started to take a root at the heart of organizations. So that's from risk. It's from, see robotics now been widely used in so many organizations to automate tasks. So, it's moved from intelligence to knowledge to task. But even that's spreading further, and we see a lot of startup activity happening in people analytics. We see a huge amount in cyber. So there's in and out cyber and so on. So it's really interesting. Digital has enabled data and analytics, and we've seen this kind of manifestation coming down into the heart of organizations. Digital in many ways is done. Or it should be done for most people, or most people are on that journey. I think we're much earlier in the data and analytics journey. And when I think about data and analytics and its application, so I was really struck by Marion's talk. I think I'm the closest, or I can really resonate with being a citizen data science, because I think as a business person about how I can use data and the sciences behind data to actually create value. And when I think about that value, I think about customers, I think about colleagues, and then I think about community. Because I think business leaders really need to think about their role as stewards, and then the application of data and analytics in a stewardship capacity. So how can we create value for customers, which as a result creates value for the organization, but that as a result creates value for the colleagues in the organization. There's huge disruptive things happening. I mean, Joan talked about the automation of work, and Catherine, you know, we've talked about that a little bit earlier on as well, and the stewardship of business leaders in their organizations for colleagues, which is one of the reasons I got involved in education. So I'm involved with the Institute of Banking. We've developed programs on data and analytics, and to maybe one of your questions, is ethics part of that? We call it culture, and it is one of three pillars actually in a 11-9 postgrad program we've developed. So it's strategy and culture. It's then harvesting the assets in an organization to create a data and analytic, to deliver on a data and analytic strategy. And then it's about delivering the outcomes, which is asking the right questions and making sure you apply it. And applying it in that customer value sense, applying it in a colleague sense. And then, you know, the stewardship for business leaders really comes back to that community aspect. So, you know, with the decisions that are being made or we're making with data and analytics and with, you know, incredible advances, it was hugely exciting. I think ethics comes into where are we at in our maturity curve about really understanding the impacts that data and analytics is going to have in that realm.
And in specifically in those environments, is ethics or culture, is it something beyond and genuinely beyond in the conversation, beyond meeting regulatory requirements? Or, you know, does it really just mean so that we don't get caught?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Full stop. Of course it is. But it is probably at the outer fringes of the conversations now in strategic conversations in organizations. So if you think about the journey of describing, predicting and prescribing, you know, they're the three phases of data and analytics in many ways. I think, you know, lots of organizations are back at how do we just gather and architect the data so that we can start describing, which allows us then to think about, you know, predicting, which allows us to maybe think about prescribing. And I think ethics surrounds all of that. But actually, I think a lot of organizations are back at the foundational data architecture level and then thinking about how do they create that describing, those insights in the organization. So I think where organizations are at, Ronan, on their maturity curve, but actually I think in reality, most of them are right back in the epicenter. Absolutely. So I think that's why I say it's on the fringes of strategic discussion, but it is critical. It's absolutely critical, which is why we're talking about it in an educational perspective. And it's great to, you know, academia have a huge role to play in this conversation. We've got to put culture and ethics at the start of the conversation, not at the fringes, because the pace of adoption and application is frightening. I mean, you know, 5 clicks. It's pretty frightening, Marion. You know, and I've seen that in business, and I've seen positive results, and I have seen, you know, pretty potentially detrimental impacts. So that's why I go back to: does it need to be a conversation? Full stop. Yes.
Brilliant. Okay, I got to thank you all very much. Great introduction. This is a conversation, and a conversation I want to engage everybody in. One of the interesting topics, I suppose, associated with technology, it is continuously changing. And some of the things which we do today and with the technologies we build and the data we gather, in the future, who knows what we might have as technology or where we might want to go. So it's often only once a technology has kind of come into widespread use that we really start to think about the ethical implications. We build it for one purpose, or we build it because we can. We don't necessarily think about ethics at that point. It could be drones, aren't they? A cool thing. It's easy to build them. But it suddenly introduces all sorts of things as ethical issues, from have we made this too easy to, you know, spy on people or to use them to launch missiles or something into some other jurisdiction, something that was never in the concept when somebody was building a consumer product. Are we too reactive when it comes to thinking and introducing data ethics into the things we do as businesses? And this could be, maybe you're working in financial services and we're working on new forms of products and fintech. Maybe that is changing the control of power of government versus private sector. Is Libra trying to displace the entire control of currency systems by the Facebook currency? Are we creating an organization in Switzerland that displaces governmental control over currencies? And as distinct from, we're just doing something which is useful for me as a way of trading. Do we think about these things when we create technology, Joan, perhaps?
Well, I certainly think that we need to think about these. And increasingly, in terms of my own experience working directly with industry and on more sort of core research projects, we are, and we are embracing these issues. But maybe in terms of how we're doing it, we could be better. So certainly at the moment, it seems that there's people are questioning issues around data protection and maybe to an extent our identity and the purpose and intended use of technologies. But in terms of being reactive as opposed to proactive and predictive, looking at issues around the unintended consequences. So looking into the future and saying, well, what might the psychosocial impacts of a piece of technology be? We're not necessarily very good at that. Now, we don't need to be feeling fearful, because we actually have tools to use, and these are increasingly being used in projects and industry projects. So, for example, in my own research, as part of human factors methods, one of the things that we do is an ethics canvas. And this allows us to look at, well, what are the consequences? And why are we looking at consequences? Because, as I mentioned in some ethical theory, one way to look at the moral quality of a piece of technology is looking at its impact in terms of consequences. So we can look at, well, how does it change behavior? How does it change what it means to be human and what we do? And in whatever particular scenario you're doing, what is at stake? One of the things that we use is we use personas and scenarios. So we actually get at the person, and I suppose it's all about what comes first. In this room, I expect the word data comes first, maybe. And I don't mean to prejudge the experience of people in the room, but I suppose I would say the word human comes first, and benefit and meaning and value. So we need to look at this space of ontological design and use certain techniques. So human factors certainly provide safeguards. And in research projects, which I've been part of, we are using these and using these successfully. And we have KPIs around ethics. And this is quite new and innovative, but it is having traction and proving very impactful, and actually getting to the kernel of what we need to be doing.
Okay. Garvin, I'm going to ask you a question. So you're obviously involved in trying to transform, processes and services and these new things in financial services.
Sure.
Are those businesses actually able to perceive further implications as to what might be introduced, the implications of that data?
So I think yes and no. A bit of context for that. You talked about Libra and so on. Libra is just a manifestation of the fourth industrial revolution. Do you know what I mean? So what happens, technologies are used to, power on businesses, society, communities, propositions, et cetera, et cetera. And if I go back, and I think the human point is very important that Joan makes. I mean, if you go back and you sit in most organizations now, we're using design thinking. We're using ethnography. It's just another way to collect data and assimilate it, but it's very, it's qualitative. So I think you see that maturing when you think about organizations and proposition development. I don't see that in the application of data and analytics. For instance, I wonder, should we see, and Niall may talk about this, but when we come out with a new drug, we go into clinical trials, and when we talk about proposition, we see design thinking go to MVP, go into MSP, minimal scalable product, and so on and so forth. That's pretty mature now when it comes to digital products and services and propositions, but that's when it's delivered digitally. The practice of data and AI is using the data that manufacturers to create further business value, often within the organization, that might end up in the proposition again. And I don't believe that we have those methodologies, those practices. I'm really interested in the ethics canvas. I'm going to have a look at that, Joan, because that sounds like a tool we should be using. So we have a business model canvas that most, anyone in startup is using and is developing, lean, agile, all these frameworks are pretty mature. I don't see those coming to play in data and analytics to the same degree. And I believe we should. I mean, back to Marion's piece on the five-click outcome, I wonder why there's not a sixth click, which is what's the anti-algorithm say? Tackling things like bias. So, why aren't we holding the mirror up? Because that's what design thinking does. It holds the mirror up. That's what the agile framework does. It allows you to really frequently and regularly and in small bites figure the journey. I would love to see that applied in the application of data and analytics. I would say further than love, I think it's necessary.
There was me thinking the sixth button was just the ethics button that you get. I'll have ethics, please.
Catherine. Yeah, no, I'd like to add to that. Part of that, and it's something that I actually get a bit of a bee in my bonnet about, is the idea of data science not actually being as scientific as people would like. Because where are the counterfactuals? A lot of the time when we're looking at data science and data analytics, we are looking for correlations and extrapolating and predicting from that, but we're not necessarily testing the falsifiability. We're not necessarily looking and seeing, you know, what are we missing? Where did things go wrong? What are our assumptions? And that is incredibly, incredibly problematic. So basically, if you don't have those, you might as well be talking about the flying spaghetti monster. Because you're looking at correlations and you're predicting according to correlations. And so that's just from a scientific perspective, but it's also when you're looking at the impact on humans, what are we missing? What are our assumptions? What are the ways that we are organizing our taxonomies that create a norm that misses out on something really, 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 really important? We need to constantly be testing ourselves and testing our ideas to destruction to see what we're doing wrong.
I think just to the, and again, to build on that and a closing point I have, and I'll link it back to Libra. So when I think of innovation that's happening globally, innovation, 5 years ago happened in organizations. Innovation now is much more happening across organizations. It's happening at a global level, a societal level. And so we see those trends. So we see Libra, blockchain and digital technologies. We see huge movements at the moment in digital identity and credentials. Again, I'm involved in a couple of initiatives like that, where it's not organizations trying to solve it. Organizations have figured out that they can't solve it themselves. In the global world, it's got to be global solutions. And some of the conversation that I have with clients is thinking about AI as a baby, because mm-hmm. I think it is at a baby. So what do you do when you have a baby or when you have a young one? You know, you think about forgiveness, you think about guidance, you think about again, that maturity curve. And I think in business, we need to think about AI in that way. How do we create those conditions to move from baby to toddler to adolescent and so on? And again, that's about putting the kind of the frameworks and the ethics around that. But innovation is great, with Libra and so on, because that's, pushing the boundaries. So you always got to have folks pushing the boundaries. But you've also then got to have the folks who are trying to put that, those baby steps in place so we can do it safely and securely. And I think that's the essence of, in many ways, what we're talking about.
And Niall, you kind of touched on this in your introduction. So you're talking about product development, you're talking about immediately implications that aren't, so the services make sure the care has been delivered effectively, but you're immediately questioning, well, that may lead to other challenges. Are other businesses as good at actually thinking about that? I think.
In a capitalist world, people are always going to, innovate. They're always going to think of new ways to use technology. They're always going to build new things. Some of those people will think about the consequences. Some of those people won't. So for example, this, concept of a vision analytics in a room. I know that somewhere in the world, there's a startup or there's someone who's just going to build that and they're just going to try and sell it. And they won't have thought about the consequences. Whether anyone will buy it or not, I don't know. I mean, lots of startups, start and fail because they actually haven't really tested their hypothesis. They've got a technology idea. They haven't really thought about, well, is this the right thing to build? Are people going to buy it? How people are going to use it, et cetera. So you've got a natural selection, I suppose, there in terms of which of those ideas and which of those companies survive and which don't. I think, I think the Apple Watch is a good, and a part of the problem with healthcare is that digital is most definitely not done in healthcare. Digital is still, only at the beginning in healthcare, really. A lot of that has been driven by regulation and incentives in the US market, which has resulted in the mass digitization of healthcare records in the US market. But a lot of innovation around healthcare is driven out of Silicon Valley by people who are not representative of the world, I would say, and are solving problems, from their perspective. So take the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch is what, a $400 device, great device, has a algorithm in it that will detect atrial defibrillation, which is a huge healthcare problem and often goes undetected. Fantastic innovation. $300 or $400 device, only certain people in the world are going to be able to afford to have that device. Now, the question is, well, does that mean that Apple shouldn't have done that? I don't believe that that's, I don't believe that that's the right question to ask, because I think that's important innovation. And them doing that innovation in a $400 device at some point will be available in a way that is for, you know, more democratic. So, you know, in response to the question, I think the people who think about these things are the people that are going to be successful. But I also think that you cannot leave innovation unchecked. You know, capitalism is capitalism. Right. Yeah. You need regulation in order to police that people are actually doing the right things and to create the environment for people to do the right things.
So, technological advancement is inevitable. Is it always good? I don't know. That's probably a question. But whose responsibility is to decide? So if we take, and we take something like Libra, market forces, it's a great opportunity. Who could control that? Well, maybe we create this benevolent grouping. But we are actually, with things like Bitcoin or whatever, we are actually inverting some existing societal controls, norms, sometimes going around the regulations and all of that. So when we have technological advancement, it's always good. And whose responsibility is it to decide that? Does it require regulation, or where does it come? Joan, maybe.
Well, I suppose just to be clear that we are, you know, all of us here are producers as well as consumers of more or less ethical technology. So we need to understand our own role, you know. I think, you know, I've worked a lot in safety critical systems. So, for instance, in aviation, and it's an awful thing to say, but air disasters really have a role to play in terms of improving quality, because we learn from the lessons learned, which is loss of life and maybe something that's gone wrong between teamwork, between pilots, or an error or something in terms of the automated system and communication. And recently we know what's happened last year with Boeing. So this kind of forces our hand a bit. But it's not great that that's, you know, that we have to react and that we should be, you know, actually engaging with technology and in a more sort of progressive way and asking these questions. So I think there's it's morally incumbent on, you know, designers to understand their role and to engage in responsible design and development, which spans these different areas that I've defined. And that isn't always easy. And certainly it requires, you know, teams of people with different expertise who have different takes on things. I have direct experience of working with industry where, you know, so my job as a researcher is to provide evidence, sometimes to build models, but mostly evidence to help in terms of adjudicating, you know, in terms of design decisions, saying this is the right thing to do. This is because this is the stakeholder need and this is the value and the benefit. But I'm not always listened to, you know, and that's just the reality. And, you know, and it's an awkward line for me, because as a researcher, you know, if they're sponsoring research, they want you to say things that are good for their institutional investors, for example. And they want you almost to validate their product. But the process of doing the research is to validate, but come up with, well, what's working and what's not working? What are the ethical issues, you know? And maybe you can't do this or implement it in the way that you want. Now, I always say it's around implementation. So all problems need to be solved in implementation, not in the design studio. So you actually roll something out and you learn about use and you actually learn about ethics in the real world. So I think let's take a lot of things into implementation and learn. But, you know, simulation is enormously helpful for this. It's not always embraced. People like, you know, quick answers, but we need to learn in doing and practicing and, you know, using, you know, a principles-based approach. Now, I just want to say one thing that I read only a few days ago was around Deutsche Telekom. And they have, there's lots of different people I've been surveying who have ethics canvases and different programs in terms of how they're defining what they're doing and how it meets an acceptable ethical vision. And they're using a mix of theories and doing quite a good job and showing a way forward. So maybe look at that. Another thing, not to promote the research here at Trinity. So I'm in the School of Psychology, but my partner's school in computer science, some of you may know ADAPT, they have a very good ethics canvas. Please look at that. So there is things to be done, but do implementation, you know, and learn about ethics through implementation.
Can I ask the question? So in asking whose responsibility is regulation, is the creation of regulations, is that how we respond to this? Do we create regulations? Do we Catherine?
It's one of the many. So my response to the question, in the first question in general, is it's everyone's, everyone has a role in decision making and in deciding what's, whether or not something is ethical. Regulatory decisions on that are incredibly important, but they're a codification of our societal expression of what's ethical and what's not. It's an incredibly important one because it does, again, help keep everyone to that standard, whether or not they agree with it or not. It helps keep the unethical people or people who don't care about that so much to that standard that society has. But regulation and law is not going to be the only way, and it cannot. Because, again, law is not necessarily going to always reflect the most ethical decisions. And you can see that right now with the way laws and norms are being violated in the U.S. We're looking at human rights violations. And one of the things that we are looking at is we are looking at coders and employees in tech companies, in data companies, who are saying, no, I'm taking my code down off of GitHub because my company has a contract with ICE and ICE is violating human rights. So I cannot continue to allow my work to benefit government organization that is tearing families apart and putting children in concentration camps. So there are red lines. We're all going to have to, at some point, make ethical decisions. Laws and regulations are an incredibly important part of that, but you're going to have to individually make your own decisions as well.
Kevin?
Yeah, to answer your question, I think the customer ultimately decides.
Yeah.
But by exchanging money for services and so on, that's too simple. I think there's a whole portfolio approach required. I'd go back to businesses as stewards in the middle, because ultimately for the customer to exchange money for services, they do that on the basis of trust. And I think organizations need to have that stewardship mindset and mantle to ensure that we exchange on trust. And you see industries moving from product to customer. But you also see industry slowly but surely moving from P&L to purpose. Is probably the best way I can think about describing it. And they're two really interesting vectors, or very difficult vectors. So I think about financial services, one I know well on, but I know it reflects in health and in many other industries as well, is the accountability regime that's now moving to board level. And that's big industry, right? That accountability regime has to be in startup, to the point that you're just after making, Catherine. And I think that's difficult because that is a cultural move. That's mindset, and that's changing the patterns of business. It's changing the bearings of business. And I think their regulation and law has a role to play. So what is law? Law is, how you, in my mind, it's basically how you translate ethics into rules, and Catholicism would be another, or religion's another way to think through that. And then regulation is the application of that down at a business and an operational level. So, there's a triangulation here with, business leaders and owners taking that mantle of stewardship and asking and holding the mirror up, which is a very difficult mirror to look in that shift from product to customer and from P&L to purpose. And then it's about putting the counterbalances in place in an organizational setting that allows regulation to do what regulation is set out to do, which is to uphold the law, which is to uphold the ethics. But in there happens the friction. And I actually think it's a lot to do with those vectors of moving from product to customer and P&L to purpose. I think that's where really the friction is at an organization. We should have conversations like this, and we should look to solve for that.
And I'm going to ask Niall to take on from there. In some ways, your business is a platform business. You don't have the ultimate person who may be subjected to unfairness, might be, or some unethical behavior, might be a patient. However, you're a business who has shareholders, you have your internal stakeholders, your customers are institutions, not the end citizen, not the patient. And obviously, they're also engaged in that, the medical professionals who are involved in delivering the care. How do you balance then that, which is, there are many people, but the downstream people may be affected by ethical decisions, It might be because your inherent bias in your product. It might be because the way your product is used by those institutions. But ultimately, we're talking about an effect, an unethical effect on somebody who is quite far downstream. The same thing would be true in financial services. How do you balance that?
So our mission as a company, I talked about our vision, but our mission at a company is to build technology that fosters holistic relationship-centered care. That's our mission. Yeah. And that's what guides everything that we do. And we believe that doing that is ultimately the person that benefits most from that is the person that is receiving care. So they are not our customer, but they are the person that is the only reason we exist as a company is because that person is in need of care and is in need of an organization to provide that care and people to provide that care. So really by having that as our mission, and by ensuring that everything we do is towards that goal, and also then, you know, as Joan spoke about, by making sure that we're not, you know, sitting in, I mean, all of our customers are around the world, but our software development is done in Dublin, but we have to make sure that we're not sitting in Dublin building something, you know, through a degree of abstraction, you know, that is used by people that we never think about or talk to or go and visit or see how they use the system, you know. So that's, you know, really incumbent on us to do that in order for the product to actually be successful. And for the product to be successful, you know, is how we deliver value for our shareholders. So the value model, you know, is to deliver value for the people who need care, the people providing care, the customers, but also the shareholders.
So it comes back to mission. And as Garvin said, culture. It comes back to a boardroom conversation at that level. Okay. Let's go to, a different topic here, which is fairness, and in particular, algorithmic fairness. Now, some of that is the data sets. Some of it is in how we actually write the algorithm itself. How do we do that? How do we even begin to do that, to incorporate, you know, ethical outcomes in what we do?
At every step, you have to think and analyze what could go wrong and how can we make sure it doesn't. And one of the things we do in Castlebridge is ethical impact assessments as well as data protection impact assessments. But again, when it comes to algorithmic accountability and fairness, it's making sure that you are looking at, for instance, one of the places where bias creeps in is the data set itself. Another place where it creeps in is your decision on what you're optimizing for. Another place it can creep in is, the pattern matching that happens in the pattern recognition of the algorithm. Because we live in a very unfair society, we have to be vigilant at every stage of our process of analysis, from deciding what data to gather to deciding what we're optimizing for to deciding how we're going to apply things. Because it's there at every stage.
I think it's a very human thing, actually. And I think your points are pointing back to human. So, you know, if you think about strategies and organizations, what a lot of the discussion is around at a board level down, inclusion and diversity. And I think that's what you're talking to Catherine. So how can we, you know, ensure in the data science community, in the citizen science community, that we've got representation, fair representation. I actually think it starts at a human level, and I think it manifests itself down into, you know, frameworks, methods, and ultimately into code. I mean, you know, what is digital? You know, so we used to code to do, now we code to learn, but ultimately the code just does what the coder sets it to do. So it's about fair representation at the start and the checks and balances in the journey that will potentially get us to the best outcome. But I do think we need that growing pain approach, that maturity model where we have the checks and balances in the outcome at the outcome stage. So I think your point, Catherine, runs through, right?
Yeah.
But we've been very poor at it. Yeah. So the classic ones that have been given a lot of publicity have been things like voice recognition, facial image recognition, the fact that they're probably coded, built, tested by people who look a lot like the people sitting in this room. It's people like us, to use the coined term as a thing for to name anybody in the room. And is that something that inherently we're building bias into future outcomes? And
yeah, so I would say on the point of you know, starting with the human. It's fairness for whom? So, mm-hmm. and sometimes this is about yeah. how you're framing the problem because you're focusing on one group and not another group. Right, and, yeah. you know, recently some of the projects I've been involved in, this issue of fairness in terms of stakeholders and different, I suppose, stakeholders are end users who have different goals or needs. So what's fair for one is going to be precisely unfair for the other. So a very simple example would be, I worked in a project to do with driverless vehicles and using adaptive automation. And the problem was initially framed as around road safety. And, you know, and it was looking at older adults driving cars. And the idea being that, you know, if they have certain health conditions, you know, certain sensory limitations, cognitive limitations, that maybe it's best to, you know, have full automation for them. And I was working with a car manufacturer who thought this was a great idea. So we actually said, well, look, how are we framing the problem, the design problem? And what is the question we're asking? And the ethics really starts with actually for whom and why? Mm. And we actually said, well, actually the stakeholder you're interested in, you're looking at other people on the road, other road users and passengers in cars and pedestrians. But that older adult isn't necessarily best served by high automation. So you're actually balancing issues around safety and driver persistence and driver enjoyment. And then when you start to open up the stakeholders, you think this solution needs to be optimized for a much greater number of people. And you need to actually start, well, how are we formulating the question? And ethics is around formulating the mm-hmm. right question. So the question of the good life, what are we really looking for? I know that sounds very highbrow or highfalutin, but it's a very simple question. If you buy a Fitbit, what are you doing with the Fitbit? What is it for? How are you using it? What did you want out of this? Is that a good thing to get for yourself? How could I think about this differently? What things do I want for myself? Then you broaden that out from the individual to different social cohorts and groups and communities and society. Start shifting the question. So design questions are normative, and we need to remember that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And just to pick up on your autonomous vehicle example, the question that we're asking when we're talking about the safety benefit of autonomous vehicles, one of the things that we're missing there a lot of the time is that we need to broaden that question out and check the assumption of the benefit of autonomous single unit vehicles mm-hmm. as opposed to improving public transport and making sure that our cities are good for human flourishing as opposed to designing them around the motor car.
So then you start to say, well, actually, we're looking at quite a different and look at the question more holistically. Mm-hmm. You bring in the green agenda. You bring in social participation in society in marginalized mm-hmm. communities.
If we're looking for the benefit to the elderly people that you started optimizing for, putting them in the car is not the best benefit generally anyways. It's making sure that they have a neighborhood that they can live in and reach the resources that they need without driving everywhere.
Well, there's different views on that, but certainly it's to start actually asking fundamental questions.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah, what are we doing? What questions are we asking? Yeah. Why? What data do we need for that?
Yes.
And so that's
not about data. Yeah. Data enables us to answer those questions, but it's about human beings and our purpose.
And I think the follow-on one, Joan, is on what will the impact be?
Yes.
And if you look at the Moral Machine initiative, mm-hmm. you know, that global study, and I mean, it's incredibly revealing. It's really asking the toughest ethical questions, mm-hmm. but it's very revealing of what it's showing you about social norms, regional norms, mm-hmm. those biases. Mm-hmm. They're not biases. They're inherent factors and facts. And I think it's what will the impact be in the context? So what are we trying to do? What's the job to be done? So that's the application of design thinking in data and analytics. And what will the outcome be in the context in which we deploy it?
Have people on your teams that consider social justice and ethics.
Right.
And, you know, and use stakeholder evaluation methods, you know, because that's how we start getting at this.
Yep. Can I ask specifically in the context of public sector, government, public services, and healthcare is probably a good example that many of those services are in that space. Are we at risk of having data from particular segments and not others? Are we at risk of building building algorithms that are very intelligent, but while they might serve, you know, a majority of the population, may have forgotten certain cohorts, which either through access to technology or in some other way, because they don't fit the norm from the data that was gathered from the algorithms developed around that. Are we at risk at actually greatly disadvantaging some portions of our society from this?
Yes. Last year, Philip Alston, the special rapporteur, UN special rapporteur for poverty, did a pretty in-depth study of the digital first strategy in the UK for social services. And basically what he found was that what was going on with the digital first strategy, again, and a lot of that was being able to use the analytics to decide who will, you know, how we can best serve our populations. Actually, what happened was digital first for, again, universal basic income type, social credit. I can't remember what it's called at the moment. Social benefit there. Basically, their digital first strategy to get all the data turned into digital only, which pretty much cut out of the ability to apply for benefits the most vulnerable, because they didn't have access to computers, so they couldn't apply for benefits. So the only way that they could actually apply for the social welfare benefit that they needed very, very badly was going to public libraries, which put stress on the library system, and also the budgets of the libraries were cut because of austerity. So basically what happened was strategy that was likely meant to be very beneficial and in all good intent, as well as creating efficiencies and saving money and gathering a whole bunch of data to use for analytics to see where to best put the money that you are using for efficient use of tax dollars. It ended up making things much, much worse and harming the most vulnerable the most.
Okay.
I think from a healthcare perspective, so I talked about digitization of healthcare data in the US market. Now, if you go to a big urban healthcare system in the US market that is serving an insured population, that data set in that electronic health record is not going to be a representative data set. It's going to be representative of people who have insurance. So if you take that data set then and say, right, this is the data set that we are going to use in order to redesign healthcare delivery, or we're going to take this and we're going to use this in order to, inform drug research and drug design, for example, you are going to have a very biased outcome. So I think the important thing there is, this is people asking the questions, and this has to be baked into process. What is not in this data set that I'm using, and what is that going to mean for the outcome of anything that I use this data set for?
Okay, excellent. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up with that. Thank you very much, all four of our panels, Joan, Niall, Catherine, Garvin. I hope that was useful and informative.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.